Welcome to The Lowdown. This is an AI-generated open-source news summary for general informational awareness. This product is not intended for use as official intelligence. The views expressed here are solely those of the cited authors and do not reflect the official policy or position of the Department of War, the United States Air Force, or any other U.S. government agency.
Right. So here is your operational bottom line up front. Modern superpowers are aggressively shifting away from traditional territorial conquest and are instead using kinetic military maneuvers as leverage in broader informational and economic wars. Based on the mid-June 2026 reporting from the Institute for the Study of War, this cognitive warfare approach is now the defining pattern across the Middle East, Eastern Europe, and the Indo-Pacific.
Yeah, and that is exactly why we're taking a deep dive into these ISW updates today, because if you just look at the raw reports, it feels like pure chaos out there.
It really does, yeah.
Missiles in the Middle East, grinding artillery in Eastern Europe, maritime standoffs in the Indo-Pacific. But like you said, in the bottom line, it's not random. It's highly coordinated.
Exactly. I mean, the physical battlefields has almost become secondary. The aircraft carriers and drone swarms are basically being played like cards in a high-stakes poker tournament. The real game is psychological.
Right. It's about forcing the opponent to fold at the negotiating table, right? So let's start in the Middle East area of responsibility, because we are seeing what we might call, missiles as memos playing out between Iran and the U.S.
Right. And this current escalation cycle kicked off over the water on June 8th. An Iranian drone intercepted and downed a U.S. Apache helicopter off the coast of Oman.
Which is, a major kinetic event.
Oh, absolutely. A direct strike on a U.S. military asset.
Yeah.
And the U.S. response was immediate. On June 9th and 10th, American forces struck roughly 20 targets across southern Iran.
Okay, 20 targets. And we're talking about significant infrastructure here, right? Like Bandar Abbas International Airport and facilities on Kisham Island.
Right, exactly. The ISW notes the objective there was to systematically degrade Iranian radar, air defenses, and their drone command units.
Okay, so the U.S. degrades those capabilities, and then Iran responds by launching a massive barrage of drones and missiles back at U.S. bases across the region.
Right, specifically targeting installations in Jordan, Kuwait, and Bahrain.
But, and correct me if I'm wrong here, almost all of those incoming projectiles were intercepted by U.S. air defense.
They were, yeah. Most were shot down. I think one landed near the U.S. Navy 5th Fleet headquarters in Bahrain, but there were no casualties reported.
So wait. If the U.S. is successfully knocking out Iran's radar systems and Iran's retaliatory missiles are mostly just hitting empty sand or, getting intercepted, isn't Iran technically losing that exchange?
Well, it looks like a failure if you judge it by traditional military metrics. But the ISW assesses that these strikes aren't designed to have a devastating military effect.
Oh, okay. So what's the actual goal then?
Their true purpose is informational and economic. I mean, Iran knows it cannot defeat the U.S. in a conventional war.
Right.
But they also know that a massive, prolonged exchange of fire will absolutely panic global energy markets.
Ah, right. So they're signaling that they're willing to create persistent instability.
Exactly. The leverage isn't the ability to sink a U.S. ship. The leverage is the ability to cause global oil prices to skyrocket. And they doubled down on that by officially declaring the Strait of Hormuz closed.
Wow. I mean, that is one of the most critical oil choke points on the planet.
It is. And the Persian Gulf Strait Authority was literally broadcasting messages telling commercial vessels to just remain patient. And the threat works because the strait is narrow, shipping lanes are predictable, and, even the mere threat of sea mines can cause insurance premiums to double.
Right. And the U.S. isn't just ignoring that, though. They're countering with their own economic pressure, right?
Yeah, the U.S. is actively enforcing a blockade on Iranian ports. They're disabling non-compliant oil tankers trying to move Iranian crude. Just in this reporting period, the ISW highlighted three major vessels that were disabled.
Right, the Jelvir, the Setabello, and the Merivex.
Exactly. So both sides are trading blows to force the other side to the negotiating table under immense economic duress.
And we're actually seeing the messy reality of that diplomatic table leak out into the public, because there was this leaked draft of a memorandum of understanding. Right?
Yeah, the leaked MOU. And it is causing absolute chaos within the Iranian government itself. Hardline media outlets linked to the IRGC, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, published this draft, and it's just filled with maximalist demands.
Maximalist demands like what?
Well, according to this draft, Iran would retain formal management of the Strait of Hormuz, they'd get billions in frozen assets released, and secure a U.S.-funded reconstruction plan for the damage caused by the recent strikes.
That sounds like they're demanding a total U.S. surrender, but didn't Iran's actual lead negotiator dispute that?
Yeah, Abbas Araghchi publicly came out and disputed the deal, telling the media to stop speculating. It really highlights the internal division. You have hardliners, like IRGC Commander Ahmad Vahidi, trying to publicly box the negotiators into these extreme terms.
While the diplomats are probably just dealing with the reality that their economy is being squeezed.
Right, and the stakes of this are incredibly high.
Yeah.
The ISW reported that U.S. President Donald Trump actually canceled a series of planned follow-on strikes against Iran late on June 11th.
Really? Why were they canceled?
The reason he cited was that discussions had reached the absolute highest levels of government. So Iran's strategy of pushing right up to the brink of a regional war to force a diplomatic settlement is actively shaping the U.S. military response.
Which perfectly illustrates that bottom line you mentioned. You don't need overpowering military success to exert global leverage. You just target the global economy.
Exactly.
And ironically, we're seeing that exact same lesson play out in reverse over in Eastern Europe. Only this time, it's a massive military being crippled by targeted strikes on its logistics.
Right. Looking at the Russia-Ukraine war, the contrast between posturing and reality is stark.
Yeah, I like to think of Russia's current strategy like a Hollywood movie set. You know, from the front, it's this imposing, intimidating facade, but behind the scenes, the foundation is crumbling.
That's a great analogy. The ISW notes an intense campaign of informational posturing from Moscow. For example, the U.S. recently warned Ukraine that Russia was preparing to launch an Oreshnik intermediate-range ballistic missile from their Kapustin Yar testing range.
And they deliberately timed that threat for June 12th, right? Russia Day.
Exactly. It's a massive, terrifying weapon meant to send a specific message to Western capitals. And they're doing the same thing with their troop deployments.
Right, expanding those military bases near NATO borders.
Yeah, up in the Republic of Karelia and Murmansk, places like Pechanga. They're designing these facilities to theoretically accommodate up to 115,000 troops after the war in Ukraine eventually ends.
So it's all about projecting the illusion of infinite resources.
It's exactly. Vladimir Putin wants Western politicians and the Ukrainian public to feel a sense of inevitability. But when you look at the tactical reality on the ground, the facade really falls apart.
Let's talk about that reality, because the ISW reports detail what's happening in a city called Kostiantynivka.
Right. That was supposed to be Russia's main effort for their spring-summer 2026 offensive. The Russian military command actually set a hard deadline to seize the city by May.
And they just completely missed it.
Completely missed it. They have two massive tactical groups, the Bakhmut and Zhuzhensk groups, taking astronomical casualties just to infiltrate roughly 12% of the urban area.
Wow, just 12%. And the manpower issues are getting worse, right?
Yeah, the ISW highlighted a staggering statistic. Russian volunteer recruitment in the first quarter of 2026 dropped by 20% compared to the same time in 2025.
So even with massive signing bonuses, they can't replace their losses.
No, they can't. And this is where Ukraine's asymmetric strategy comes in. Ukraine isn't just absorbing the artillery fire. They are systematically dismantling the logistics network that allows Russia to fight.
Yeah, the mechanics of these deep strikes are fascinating. We're talking about targets hundreds of kilometers away from the front lines.
A prime example is the Ukrainian strike on the VNIR Progress plant. They use an FP-5 Flamingo cruise missile to hit this facility in Jibiksary, which is over 900 kilometers away from the fighting.
Okay, so why use a highly valuable cruise missile on a factory 900 kilometers away? What makes it so important?
Because that plant manufactures the advanced navigation equipment and specialized antennas used in Russia's Shahed attack drones and their Iskander ballistic missiles.
Oh, wow. So without those components, the drones are basically useless.
Exactly. A drone without navigation is just blind fiberglass.
Mm.
By hitting that factory, Ukraine is essentially destroying the weapons that would be killing their soldiers 3 or 4 months from now.
They are literally starving the future supply chain.
Right. And they did the same thing with the Kubishevsky oil refinery, which is over 1,000 kilometers away, causing it to halt primary oil processing.
Which directly ties into the fuel shortages Russian forces are facing. But if we're talking about military genius in this logistics war, we have to talk about the Chonhar bridge trap near Crimea.
Oh, absolutely. That was a masterclass in manipulating enemy movements.
Walk us through how that played out, because it's pretty incredible.
So Ukraine strikes the Chonhar Bridge, which is a major multi-lane supply artery feeding Russian troops in occupied Kherson. By damaging that specific bridge, Russian logisticians panicked.
Right, they had to reroute everything.
Exactly. They had to immediately reroute all of their heavy traffic through an alternate path, a single, highly predictable narrow road near a town called Armiansk.
So Ukraine forces the entire Russian supply chain into this massive bottleneck.
Yes. And once Ukraine knew exactly where all those Russian fuel and ammo trucks were packed together, bumper to bumper, they launched a coordinated strike on that exact road.
And the ISW reported a Ukrainian commander said they destroyed roughly 50 Russian military cargo vehicles in that single trap.
50 trucks carrying the fuel and bullets the front line desperately needs, gone in an instant. The contrast here is the most important takeaway.
Yeah, Russia threatens to launch intermediate-range missiles to scare politicians, while Ukraine meticulously dismantles the fuel trucks actually needed to fight.
Exactly. One side is fighting for the headlines, the other is fighting for the supply lines.
Right. Okay, so we've got Russia using brute force posturing and Iran using the threat of global economic panic. Let's move to the Indo-Pacific and look at our third player, China, and what they're doing with Taiwan.
This is where we see the mastery of the gray zone.
Right, the gray zone. That's the space between peace and open armed conflict, right?
Exactly. It's coercive, aggressive tactics that deliberately stay just 1 millimeter below the threshold of an act of war. You don't send a destroyer to claim territory. You send a massive fleet of fishing boats.
Or you slowly dredge sand and build a base on a coral reef over 5 years.
Exactly. It's the methodical rewriting of international law without ever firing a shot. And the ISW reports detail a massive maritime squeeze happening right now using these tactics.
Yeah, in early June, the PRC's Ministry of Transport ran what they explicitly labeled a special maritime law enforcement operation in the waters east of Taiwan.
And the phrasing is critical there. It wasn't a naval exercise conducted by the military. It was a law enforcement operation conducted by a civilian ministry.
So they're acting as if they already own the water and are simply policing it.
Precisely. And they deliberately timed this operation to contest bilateral talks between Japan and the Philippines about their overlapping exclusive economic zones, or EEs.
Basically, sailing their ships in and saying, you can't draw borders here without our permission because we claim sovereignty over Taiwan.
Right. And the tactics are evolving. The ISW highlighted that for the first time, a PRC Coast Guard ship vessel 3501 was recorded coordinating directly with a Chinese research vessel, the High Sea Lu 6, near Taiwan's Pratas Island.
Okay, but a research vessel sounds harmless. Why is that coordination a major escalation?
Well, for years, China has used these civilian research vessels to conduct dual-use undersea surveys. They map the ocean floor ostensibly for civilian science, but really to chart routes for nuclear submarines.
Oh, okay.
They've historically relied on the scientific veneer of these ships to avoid pushback. But by having a heavily armed Coast Guard ship directly escorted in Taiwanese waters, Beijing is dropping the disguise.
They're openly asserting legal jurisdiction over Taiwan's restricted waters. It's like a mob boss sending his accountant to your business, but the accountant is flanked by two guys with baseball bats.
That's a perfect way to put it. It's about intimidation and control. And it's not just temporary patrols. The reports note China may have placed a permanent manned structure at the Scarborough Shoal in the South China Sea.
Which drew formal diplomatic protests from the Philippines, right?
Right. It's physical occupation achieved inch by inch. But the gray zone squeeze isn't just out on the water. It's happening in the halls of government, too.
Yeah, the diplomatic squeeze. I mean, we saw CCP General Secretary Xi Jinping visit North Korea, which tacitly legitimizes Kim Jong-un's nuclear status.
And more crucially, how China is attempting to hollow out Taiwan from the inside. The internal political dynamics in Taiwan are a major front in this cognitive war.
Right. The ISW updates highlighted the chairperson of Taiwan's opposition party, the KMT, Cheng Li-Wen. She conducted a 2-week visit to the U.S. to meet with lawmakers.
And her talking points aligned almost perfectly with Beijing's narrative. She publicly supported the 1992 consensus, which is basically an ambiguous agreement that both sides belong to one China.
But the shocking part to me was that she blamed NATO expansion for the war in Ukraine.
Yeah, that is a propaganda line ripped straight from the Kremlin and the Chinese Communist Party.
Why does it matter so much that an opposition leader is saying this in Washington?
Because China's ultimate goal is to win Taiwan without fighting. if they can influence the internal politics of Taiwan so heavily that the government becomes divided or sympathetic to Beijing, it completely undermines the rationale for the U.S. or its allies to intervene.
Right. China doesn't need to spread their narrative if the Taiwanese opposition leader will do it for them.
Exactly. And for anyone who doesn't play along, Beijing plays hardball. They recently placed severe sanctions on four lawmakers from New Zealand just for visiting Taiwan.
So this brings up a really crucial question. If China is successfully claiming physical territory using law enforcement boats and shaping the internal political narrative to divide their targets, how does anyone push back?
It's incredibly difficult.
Because if you shoot a research vessel, you start a war. So is there a defense against this gray zone strategy?
The defense has to be entirely asymmetric. You cannot meet a Coast Guard ship with a guided missile destroyer. The primary weapon against the gray zone is aggressive transparency and exposure.
Meaning you just shine a light on it.
Right. You fly drones over the incursions, film the Chinese vessels acting aggressively, broadcast that footage globally, and build international coalitions that publicly refuse to recognize these fabricated legal claims.
You make the invisible coercion visible to the whole world.
Exactly. And on a tactical level, Taiwan has to invest heavily in cheap, asymmetric technologies like massive domestic drone production.
To monitor and harass the incursions without risking multi-million-dollar warships.
Right. You make the environment too politically visible and costly for Beijing to operate in comfortably.
Man, so if we pull the lens all the way back and synthesize this across all three theaters, the Middle East, Eastern Europe, and the Indo-Pacific, the traditional lines of conflict have really just dissolved.
They absolutely have. The era of two massive armies lining up on a battlefield to decide a war is largely over. Physical engagements are deeply subordinate to informational and economic campaigns.
Yeah, we have Iran threatening to choke off global oil to force a diplomatic deal. We have Russia parading missiles to terrify Western capitals while their supply lines get shredded by drones. And China using Coast Guard ships as an invading navy to swallow the South China Sea.
In every case, the kinetic strikes are just punctuation marks in a narrative war. These nations are investing heavily into cognitive warfare.
Which leaves us with a final, somewhat unsettling thought. As nations increasingly use their military hardware strictly for informational and economic leverage, will the future of global conflict be decided not by who wins the physical fight, but by who controls the narrative of the war?
It's a critical question. From a briefing perspective, understanding that shift in operational significance is essential for anticipating future escalations. This concludes today's analysis of the area of responsibility reporting.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep your eyes open, and we'll see you next time.